The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 31st, 2014 edition of The Week magazine. As usual, we start with the main stories and how they were covered. Obama's plan to rein in NSA surveillance. What happened? Hoping to calm growing public unease over high-tech government surveillance, President Obama last week unveiled plans to curtail the National Security Agency's mass collection of domestic phone data and overseas spying operations. In one of the biggest changes, Obama said the government's database of metadata, such as logs of phone calls received and sent, and the locations of callers, would no longer be stored in NSA computers. The Justice Department, intelligence officials, and Congress, he said, would now jointly decide where that data should be held. Then intelligence analysts would have to get approval from a secret court before querying the database. Obama also ordered the agency to stop eavesdropping on the leaders of friendly governments, a program that caused outrage in Brazil and Germany when it was exposed by former agency contractor Edward Snowden. These reforms, along with greater oversight of the NSA, should give Americans greater confidence that their rights are being protected without damaging the agency's ability to keep us safe, Obama said. Congressional critics of NSA surveillance called Obama's proposals nothing but a fig leaf, while defenders accused the president of trying to tie the agency's hands. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden said the president should flatly stop the bulk collection of Americans' phone records, calling the program a violation of the Constitution's ban on unreasonable searches. Republican Representative Mike Rogers, chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, said Obama was injecting lots of uncertainty into the intelligence community's efforts to protect Americans by finding terrorists who are trying to reach into the United States. What the editorial said: the president's reforms are welcome, but frustratingly short on specifics, said the New York Times. Take his sensible-sounding proposal to take the phone records of every American out of the NSA's hands. Obama should have followed his own intelligence review panel's recommendation that phone companies hold the data and that the NSA request only what it needs. Instead, he punted the decision to Congress, which is certain to bicker and dither over alternative storage options. As usual, Obama is trying to satisfy all sides with empty rhetoric, said the Wall Street Journal. The president admitted that post-9/11 surveillance has prevented multiple attacks and that there was no evidence the NSA had violated any laws. So why tamper with programs that are keeping the country safe? The only possible reason is that he wants to appease the paranoids and incendiaries who make up the Democrats' left wing. What the columnist said: these proposals will cripple the NSA's greatest asset, said John Yoo in NationalReview.com. At the moment, the government can quickly search the agency's telephone database and uncover links between a safe house in Yemen, for example, and potential terrorists abroad. If agents have to wait for court approval for every search, they will lose track of terrorists who frequently switch phones and numbers to avoid detection. claims that metadata analysis has broken up terrorist plots are overblown and even misleading, said Peter Bergen in CNN.com. An analysis by the nonpartisan New America Foundation found that of 225 Islamic extremists charged with terrorism in the U.S. since 9/11, the bulk collection of telephone metadata played a role in, at most, only 1.8% of investigations. Even in these cases, the metadata was of marginal value. Traditional policing techniques, such as the use of informants, led to the arrests. Never have so many Americans been brought under surveillance for such a meager payoff, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune. If we were sacrificing our privacy to save lives, that would be one thing. Giving it up for little or nothing is another. Like it or not, few Americans share that concern, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. In an age when Internet users happily hand over troves of personal information to companies like Google and Facebook, most people simply aren't shocked that the government is sweeping up metadata and will likely greet Obama's modest reforms with a shrug. Then the intelligence community will get back to business more or less as usual. And our second main story, dim prospects for Syrian talks. A long-awaited Syrian peace conference in Montreux, Switzerland, quickly degenerated this week into a crossfire of bitter accusations, raising serious doubts for a negotiated end to the bloody civil war that has already cost more than 130,000 lives. Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualim accused Arab nations of having blood on their hands for supporting the rebels, while Syrian opposition leader Ahmad Jarba countered that President Bashar al-Assad's widespread atrocities disqualify him from any role in the transitional government that the UN-sanctioned talks are supposed to create. Secretary of State John Kerry agreed, "There is no way possible that a man who has led a brutal response to his own people can retain legitimacy to govern," he said. The conference was set to move to Geneva, where representatives are supposed to sit down face to face. Absent a miracle, the talks will fail, said Michael Doran and Michael O'Hanlon in USAtoday.com. The two warring parties traveled to Switzerland with entirely conflicting aims, unless you count their common goal of achieving the complete defeat of the other. And just consider the industrial strength mayhem that the Geneva conference would have to pacify, said Mark Ginsburg in HuffingtonPost.com. Overrun by warring gangs, rebels, terrorists, and military deserters, Syria has become the battlefield for the first full-blown Sunni-Shiite war in centuries. Neither side is about to settle. That is now too much to ask for, said Bloomberg.com in an editorial. But the factions should at least discuss a temporary ceasefire, even if it's just to bring humanitarian aid to the millions displaced in the violence. Even that won't happen without more pressure on al-Assad, said Joshua Landis in AlJazeera.com. Yet the U.S. has spent just $2 billion on Syria, the equivalent of 3 days' spending at the height of the Iraq War. The opposition has already drawn the tragic conclusion that for all the high-level talking, the U.S. has practically no interest in the country's civil war. Our controversy of the week, Benghazi. Will the Senate report hurt Clinton? It won't matter to the true believers, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But the Senate Intelligence Committee last week confirmed what rational observers have known all along about the right's beloved Benghazi obsession. There is no there. After a 16-month investigation, the bipartisan committee concluded that the 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission that killed four Americans, including Ambassador Chris Stevens, was likely preventable, but found no cover-up by the Obama administration. Potential rescuers weren't ordered to stand down, as claimed by Fox News. There is no evidence that al-Qaeda leaders planned or directed the attack. As for Susan Rice's infamous talking points, describing the attack as at least partly fueled by street rage over an anti-Muslim YouTube video, they not only reflected the CIA's best intelligence at the time, but, wait for it, may turn out to have been correct. The best news for Democrats, said David Horsey in the Los Angeles Times, is that the words Hillary Clinton appear nowhere in the committee's 58-page report, meaning not much damage was done to the former Secretary of State's prospects as a presidential candidate. Clinton may not have been personally named, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, but as Secretary of State, she was the person responsible for the disaster. Throughout the summer of 2012, there was a crescendo of small-scale attacks on diplomatic personnel in Benghazi, yet Clinton's State Department did nothing whatsoever to beef up security. Somehow, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, it escaped the State Department's notice that Libya was being overrun by jihadis. And contrary to liberal spin, the report states unambiguously that members of groups affiliated with al-Qaeda did participate in the attack. Now that her incompetence and lies have been exposed, Clinton may well be too hobbled to run for the White House. One almost admires the tenacity of those still waging the GOP jihad over Benghazi, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. They once fantasized about destroying Clinton and impeaching President Obama with proof they callously abandoned Stevens to his fate and then lied to cover it up. Now we have the truth, that there simply were no military assets close enough to reach Benghazi in time, and that Stevens himself twice declined offers of extra security. So all Republicans have left is the lame assertion that the attack could have been prevented had everyone seen it coming. Frankly, we knew that. How is the preventable slaughter of Americans not a scandal? Asked Ed Morrissey in physicaltimes.com. The ultimate blame must rest with Obama himself, whose lack of follow-through after Muammar al-Qaddafi's ouster is why eastern Libya became a terrorist haven in the first place. Obama and Clinton are guilty, at least, of wishful thinking, said Amy Davidson in newyorker.com. As Benghazi grew more and more dangerous, the White House and State Department, like Stevens, seemed to have clung to the idea that we had entered the happily ever after part of the Libyan tale, in which the grateful residents of this scrappy new democracy would treat Americans like honored guests. That rosy outlook left the administration unprepared when, in the space of a few short hours, the fairy tale ended with heavily armed Libyans storming the Stevens compound. At the bottom of this page, we'll go ahead and take a look at the good week, bad week blurbs. It was a good week for stocking up on munchies. After the Denver Broncos and the Seattle Seahawks, teams from the only two U.S. states to legalize recreational marijuana advanced to the Super Bowl, leading some to call the upcoming game the Stoner Bowl. It was a good week for using what you learned. After a University of Michigan, Flint, business major started selling ad space on his graduation cap to help pay off his student loans. If an advertiser wants to put a little figurine up there on my hat, said Alex Benda. I'm fine with that. It was a good week for additional firearms training. After an Indiana police chief shot himself in the leg while trying out a weapon in a gun shop. The second time in 15 years he'd suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I need to pay more attention, admitted David Counselor. It was a bad week for emergency services. After a Florida police officer was forced to resign when his superiors discovered he had used the 9/11 system to arrange extramarital trysts. Sean Whiting had his mistress call 911 and quickly hang up so he would be dispatched to her location. It was a bad week for sharing. After fugitive Anthony James Leskowitz Jr. of Pennsylvania posted a police photo and wanted bulletin of him on his Facebook page with the sneering comment, LOL, I blanking love it. He received 2 likes and an invitation from an undercover officer posing as an admiring female, which led to his arrest. It was a bad week for internet privacy after security experts revealed that password was no longer the most commonly used password, but said the new favorite, 123456, might be even more vulnerable. Over on the briefing page this week, Mexico's drug kings. The Sinaloa cartel is now the world's biggest supplier of illegal narcotics. How did it become so powerful? What is the Sinaloa cartel? The Mexican crime syndicate is the world's most powerful drug trafficking organization and the biggest supplier of illegal narcotics in the U.S. About half of the estimated $65 billion worth of cocaine, heroin, and other illegal drugs that American users buy each year enters the U.S. via Mexico. Sinaloa, which is named after its home state in western Mexico, controls more than half of that cross-border trade, from which it earns at least $3 billion a year. U.S. law enforcement officials say the group has a presence in all major American cities and a near monopoly on the wholesale distribution of heroin and cocaine in Chicago. The city's crime commission has branded Sinaloa's elusive leader, Joaquin Guzman, also known as El Chapo or Shorty, public enemy number one, a title last held by Al Capone. What Al Capone was to beer and whiskey, said commission member Arthur Billick, Guzman is to narcotics. How did the cartel get started? Mexican smugglers have long trafficked homegrown heroin and marijuana to the U.S. But in the 1980s, Mexico also became the primary route for Colombian cocaine bound for the U.S. At the time, U.S. law enforcement was cracking down on the Colombian drug producers' attempts to ship the lucrative drug into Florida by boats and planes. So the Colombians hired Mexico's Guadalajara cartel to smuggle drugs across the border and paid them in cocaine, which allowed the Mexicans to build their own drug networks in the U.S. Before long, the Mexicans were the senior partners in the relationship. When Guadalajara's leader was arrested in 1989, the group's remaining capos, including young Guzman, divided up its trafficking routes, creating the Sinaloa, Juarez, and Tijuana cartels. These gangs soon became locked in a series of turf wars that have killed more than 60,000 people. But throughout the bloodshed, El Chapo's organization has continued to grow. Why has Sinaloa succeeded? The 5'6" Guzman may be a grade school dropout, but he's also a logistical genius, said Jack Riley, the head of the Drug Enforcement Administration's Chicago Division. He's trafficked cocaine from Colombia to Mexico in small private planes, in the luggage of airline passengers, and on the cartel's own 747s. Sinaloa has also moved cocaine on custom-built $1 million submarines. El Chapo, 56, has shown similar ingenuity moving drugs from Mexico to the U.S. He's built scores of tunnels under the border, some of which are air-conditioned and boast half-mile-long trolley lines. He's sent drugs through U.S. checkpoints, in hidden car compartments, in cans of jalapenos, and in the bellies of frozen shark carcasses. Once in the U.S., the drugs are ferried to warehouses in Chicago, which Gutzman has called his home port, before being divided up and distributed across the nation. Why Chicago? It's the transportation hub of America. The city is located within a day's drive of 70% of the nation's population and is crisscrossed by major interstate highways and railway lines. Chicago is also a huge drug market in its own right. Some 86% of people arrested in Cook County in 2012 tested positive for at least one illegal narcotic, the highest percentage of any big U.S. city. With his monopoly in the city, Gutzman doubled wholesale heroin prices, thus cutting profit margins for street dealers. That fueled greater competition for turf and exacerbated Chicago's epidemic of gang violence. It used to be honor among thieves, said Harold Ward, a former gang member turned anti-violence campaigner. Now it's by any means necessary. How violent is the cartel? Sinaloa can be exceedingly brutal. It left 14 severed heads in ice boxes outside a mayor's office in the northern Mexican city of Nuevo Laredo in 2012. But compared with other cartel leaders, El Chapo is a practical businessman who prefers bribe over bullet. He invests millions in corrupting police and government officials in Mexico rather than intimidating them with violence. There is a level-headedness about Sinaloa's leadership that the other groups lack, said Malcolm Bythe, author of a book on Gutzman titled The Last Narco. Some observers claim that this fact has led both Mexican and U.S. authorities to go easy on Sinaloa. Is that allegation true? A 2010 National Public Radio investigation of Mexican arrest records noted that Sinaloa had suffered notably fewer arrests than other cartels. U.S. court documents also show that top Sinaloa officials regularly met with DEA agents between 2006 and 2012 and fed them intelligence about rival cartels, helping law enforcement crush their competitors. U.S. and Mexican officials have denied showing any favoritism towards Sinaloa, and the DEA has arrested several high-ranking cartel members in recent years, including Jesus Vicente Zambada Niebla, the son of the organization's number two leader, Ismael Zambaba. In a rare 2010 interview, the senior Zambada said that such arrest had no effect on the cartel and that its drugs would keep flowing north even if El Chapo were brought down. When it comes to the capos, jailed, dead, or extradited, he said, the replacements are ready. El Chapo's great escape. In 1993, Gutzman was captured and sentenced to 20 years for conspiracy, bribery, and drug trafficking. But even after he was sent to Mexico's maximum security Puente Grande prison, he continued to run his empire and live a life of luxury. With most of the prison officials on his payroll, he ordered meals from a menu, organized drug deals on cell phones, and had prostitutes, his wife, and several lovers brought in on prison trucks, as well as a supply of Viagra. Then in January 2001, El Chapo tired of being locked up and was reportedly wheeled out of the prison inside a laundry cart. Many Mexicans believe prison officials, in fact, let the drug lord walk out. What actually happened may never be known, as security camera footage from that night disappeared, and records of vehicles entering and leaving the jail were erased. We'll take a look now at the best columns from the U.S., starting with one from Avik Roy at Forbes.com. Obamacare's illusory enrollments. Amid all of Obamacare's broken promises and disappointments, said Avik Roy, the law supporters have clung to one consoling thought. Millions of uninsured Americans would finally get health coverage. But it's beginning to look as if that, too, is an empty dream. Analysis of new data from insurers about the 2.2 million Obamacare enrollments so far indicates that at least two-thirds of these people already had coverage and are simply replacing policies they previously bought on the individual market. One survey by the prestigious McKinsey firm found that only 11% of the new Obamacare enrollees were previously uninsured. The cost of policies on the exchanges, McKinsey found, is scaring people away. Even the supposed success of Medicaid expansion may be an illusion. Of the 4 million people who signed up for Medicaid coverage, another analysis found, only about 7.5% are getting coverage because of new Obamacare rules. The rest would have cycled into the program anyway. If these trends hold, and the uninsured fail to flock to Obamacare, President Obama's signature legislation may not be long for this world. From Fareed Zakaria at the Washington Post, the price of meddling in the Mideast. Did the Obama administration lose Iraq? Asked Fareed Zakaria. A host of Bush administration officials and neocons are now blaming the fall of Fallujah and Ramadi to Islamic terrorists on Obama's failure to keep thousands of American troops there. This argument betrays a continuing misunderstanding of the very deep nature of the conflict. In fact, if a single action accelerated the sectarian conflicts in the region, it was George W. Bush's decision to invade Iraq, take power from Sunni Muslims, and hand it over to their rival Shiites. That choice ignited a bitter sectarian religious conflict in Iraq that spread like a contagion throughout the Islamic world, as Sunnis, Shiites, and Islamic radicals battle for control and domination. Egypt has seesawed between Islamic and military dictatorships. Syria has devolved into bloody anarchy. And in Iraq, the oppressed Shiites are now the oppressors, with radicalized Sunnis waging civil war. Those insisting that more American military force will solve these problems are delusional. Instead, our renewed meddling in conflicts with deep historical and sectarian roots would only add fuel to the fires. And from Will Oramus at Slate.com, the quiet boom in clean tech. Clean energy technology is supposed to be dead, said Will Oramus. Conservatives have gleefully celebrated the demise of solar, wind, and other renewable forms of energy since the crash of 2011, when the Solyndra Solar Company was just one of several Obama administration-funded alternative energy startups to collapse into bankruptcy. CBS's 60 Minutes recently bought into this myth, declaring the entire clean tech industry a sheer boondoggle. But guess what? Clean tech is not dead. In fact, it's booming like never before. Over the past 2 years, solar power plants have sprouted across the sunny Southwest and will soon supply renewable clean energy to millions. On Wall Street, the stock of solar companies have exploded in value. With $13 billion privately invested in these companies in 2013, a tenfold increase over 2007. Meanwhile, individual Americans installed more solar panels in 2013 than in the past two decades combined. Chinese companies have rushed in to invest millions in U.S.-based solar companies, creating thousands of jobs for American workers. That doesn't sound like a dead industry to me or to Wall Street. We'll flip over now to the last word, the in-depth article this week titled, The Big White Ghetto. In Appalachia, said Kevin D. Williamson, jobs have vanished and people live for pills, soda pop, and welfare. There are lots of diversions in the big white ghetto, the vast moribund matrix of wonder-bread-hued Appalachian towns and villages stretching from northern Mississippi to southern New York. A slowly dissipating nebula of poverty and misery with its heart in eastern Kentucky. The last redoubt of the Scots-Irish working class that picked up where African slave labor left off. Mining and cropping and sawing the raw materials for a modern American economy that would soon run out of profitable uses for the class of people who 500 years ago would have been known without any derogation as peasants. Thinking about the future here and its bleak prospects is not much fun at all. So instead you had the pills and the dope, the morning beers, the endless scratch-off lotto cards, healing meetings up on the hill, the federally funded ritual of trading cases of food stamp Pepsi for packs of Kentucky's best cigarettes, and good old hard currency, tall piles of gas station nachos, the occasional blast of meth, Narcotics Anonymous meetings, petty crime, the draw, the recreational making and surgical unmaking of teenaged mothers, and death. Life expectancies are short. A typical man here dies well over a decade earlier than does a man in Fairfax County, Virginia. And they are getting shorter. Women's life expectancy having declined by nearly 1.1%. from 1987 to 2007. If the people here weren't 98.5% white, we'd call it a reservation. Driving through these hills, you aren't in the Appalachia of Elmore Leonard's Justified or squatting with Lyndon Johnson on Tom Fletcher's front porch in Martin County, a scene famously photographed by Walter Bennett of Time, the image that launched the so-called war on poverty. The music isn't Shady Grove, it's Kanye West. There is still coal mining, which at $25 an hour or more provides one of the more desirable occupations outside of government work. But the jobs are moving west. And Harlan County, like many coal country communities, has lost nearly half of its population over the past 30 years. There is here a strain of fervid and sometimes apocalyptic Christianity, and visions of the rapture must have a certain appeal for people who already have been left behind. Like its black urban counterparts, the big white ghetto suffers from a whole trainload of social problems, but the most significant among them may be adverse selection. Those who have the required work skills, the academic ability, or the simple, desperate, native, enterprising grit to do so, get the hell out as fast as they can. And they have been doing that for decades. As they go, businesses disappear, institutions fall into decline, social networks erode, and there is little or nothing left over for those who remain. There used to be two movie theaters here, a regular cinema and a drive-in. Both are long gone. The nearest Walmart is nearly an hour away. There's no bookstore, the nearest Barnes & Noble being 55 miles away, and the main source of reading matter being the horrifying, hilarious crime blotter in the local weekly newspaper. Within living memory, this town had three grocery stores, a Western Auto and a Napa Auto Parts, a feed store, a lumber store, a clothing shop, a Chrysler dealership, a used car dealership, a skating rink, even a discotheque back in the 1970s. Today there is one grocery store, and the rest is as dead as disco. If you want a newsstand or a dinner at Applebee's, gas up the car. Amazon may help, but delivery can be tricky. The nearest UPS drop box is 17 miles away. The nearest FedEx office, 34 miles away. If you go looking for the catastrophe that laid this area low, you'll discover a terrifying story. Nothing happened. It's not like this was a company town in which the business around which life was organized went toes up. Boonville and Owsley County were never economic powerhouses. They were sustained for a time in part by a nearby Mid-South plant, which manufactured consumer electronics such as steam irons and toaster ovens, as well as industrial supplies such as refrigerator parts. A former employee estimates that a majority of Owsley County households owed part of their income to Mid-South at one time or another, until a mishap in the sanding room put an end to that. "Those shavings are just like coal dust," he says. "It will go right up if it gets a spark." Operations were consolidated in a different facility, a familiar refrain here. But Owsley County was poor before, during, and after that period. Coal mining was for years a bulwark against utter economic ruination. But regulation, a lengthy permitting process, and other factors both economic and geological pushed what remains of the region's coal business away toward other communities. Well, you try paying that much for a case of pop, says the irritated proprietor of a nearby cafe, who is curt with whoever is on the other end of the telephone, but greets customers with perfect manners that small-town restaurateurs reliably develop. I don't think much of that overheard remark at the time, but it turns out that the local economy runs on black market soda, the way Baghdad ran on contraband crude during the days of sanctions. It works like this. Once a month, the debit card accounts of those receiving what we still call food stamps are credited with a few hundred dollars, about $500 for a family of four, on average, which are immediately converted into a unit of exchange, in this case, cases of soda. On the day when accounts are credited, local establishments accepting EBT cards are swamped with locals using their public benefits to buy cases and cases. Reports put the number at 30 to 40 cases for some buyers of soda. Those cases of soda then either go to another retailer who buys them at 50 cents on the dollar, in effect laundering those $500 in monthly benefits into $250 in cash, a considerably worse rate than your typical organized crime money launderer offers, or else they go into the local black market economy, where they can be used as currency in such ventures as the dealing of unauthorized prescription painkillers, by pillbillies, as they are known as the sympathetic establishments in Florida that do so much business with Kentucky and West Virginia, that the relevant interstate bus service is nicknamed the OxyContin Express. There's not much violent crime here. There's a bit of the usual enterprise one finds everywhere there are drugs and poor people, which is to say everywhere. But even the crime here is pretty well predictable. The police chief's assistant notes that if they know the nature and location of a particular crime, they can more or less drive straight to the perpetrator. There's a great deal of drug use, welfare fraud, and the like, but the overall crime rate throughout Appalachia is about two-thirds the national average, and the rate of violent crime is half the national average. Boonville Police Chief Johnny Logston is justifiably skeptical of the area's reputation for drug-fueled crime, but he is not blinkered. We have loggers and coal producers, he says. We have educators and local businesses and people in the arts, and we have the same problems they have in every community. He points out that the town recently opened up a $1 million public library, a substantial investment for a town in which the value of all residential property combined would not add up to the big lottery jackpot being advertised all over. He does not deny the severity or scope of the region's problems, but he does think that they are exaggerated by visitors who are here. After all, only because Owsley holds the national title for poorest county. Owsley's dependent underclass has many of the same problems as any other dependent underclass, but with a poverty rate persistently at the 40% mark, the underclass plays an outsized role in social life. This isn't the Kentucky of Elmore Leonard's imagination, and there is nothing romantic about it. These are no fiercely independent remnants of the old America clinging to their homes and their traditional ways. This is the land of families of four clutching $40 worth of lotto scratchers and crushing the springs on their beaten-down Camry while getting dinner from a Phillips 66 station. This is about the draw. The draw, the monthly welfare checks that supplement dependents' earnings in the black market Pepsi economy, is poison. It's a potent enough poison to catch the attention even of such people as those who write for the New York Times. Nicholas Kristoff, visiting nearby Jackson, Kentucky last year, was shocked by parents who were taking their children out of literacy classes because the possibility of improved academic performance would threaten $700 a month Social Security disability benefits, which increasingly are paid out for nebulous afflictions such as loosely defined learning disorders. This is painful for a liberal to admit, Kristoff wrote, but conservatives have a point when they suggest that America's safety net can sometimes entangle people in a soul-crushing dependency. There is much here to confound conservatives, too. Jim DeMint likes to say that marriage is our best anti-poverty program, and he also has a point. But a 2004 study found that the majority of impoverished households in Appalachia were headed by married couples, not single mothers. Getting and staying married is not a surefire prophylactic against poverty. Neither are prophylactics. Kentucky has a higher teen motherhood rate than the national average, but not radically so, and its young mothers are more likely to be married. Kentucky and West Virginia have abortion rates that are one-fourth those of Rhode Island or Connecticut, and one-fifth that of Florida. More marriage, less abortion. Not exactly the sort of thing out of which conservative indictments are made. But marriage is less economically valuable, at least to men in Appalachia. Like their counterparts elsewhere, married men here earn more than their unmarried counterparts, but the difference is smaller and declining. Speaking in the Rose Garden in March of 1965, Lyndon Johnson had high hopes for his Appalachia bill. This legislation marks the end of an era of partisan cynicism towards human want and misery. The dole is dead. The pork barrel is gone. Federal and state, liberal and conservative, Democrat and Republican, Americans of these times are concerned with the outcome of the next generation, not the next election. The bill that I will now sign will work no miracles overnight. Whether it works at all depends not upon the federal government alone, but the states and local governments as well. The dole, as it turns out, is deathless, and the pork barrel has merely been reincarnated as a case of Pepsi. President Johnson left out of his calculations the factor that is almost always overlooked by populists, the people. This article is adapted from one that first appeared in the December 16, 2013 issue of National Review. On the health and science page this week, we have good news for you coffee lovers out there. How caffeine sharpens your memory. Coffee is one of the most popular beverages in the world for lots of reasons, including that it gives people a pleasant lift in the morning. New research shows that it also helps their memory. Researchers had 160 people who were not regular coffee drinkers look at pictures of objects. 5 minutes later, they gave them either a placebo or a tablet containing 200 milligrams of caffeine, about the amount contained in a strong cup of coffee. The next day, participants were shown a broader set of images and asked to identify which ones were new, old, or similar. The caffeinated group was more likely to recognize slight differences in the pictures, such as a yellow rubber duck that was fatter than the one they'd seen the day before. Without these tricky similar items, we would have found no effect of caffeine, University of California, Irvine neuroscientist Michael Yassa tells Forbes.com. However, using these items requires the brain to make a more difficult discrimination, what we call a pattern separation, which seems to be the process that is enhanced by caffeine. It's the form of memory that people use, for example, to recall where they last parked their car. Caffeine's effect depends on the dosage, however. Researchers found that 100 milligram tablets didn't improve memory, while 300 milligram doses caused headaches and jitteriness. And perhaps not so good news for those of you who like a drink in the evening. Health scare of the week. Booze and the brain. Middle-aged men who drink more than two beers or the equivalent amount of alcohol a day speed up their memory loss by 6 years, reports The Guardian. Researchers at University College London studied the drinking habits of about 5,000 men and 2,000 women over 10 years. When the participants turned 56, they began taking tests of their memory, reasoning, and organizational abilities. Men who consumed an average of 2.5 drinks per day showed signs of memory loss a lot sooner than men who didn't drink or men who were light to moderate drinkers. That effect held even after researchers controlled for memory-affecting factors such as diet, exercise habits, and occupation. Light drinkers did not show the declines. There is no need to be an alcoholic to see a detrimental effect of heavy alcohol consumption on cognition, said study author Severine Sabia. Strangely, the researchers did not find similar drinking-related memory loss in women, although women who drank a lot did show deficits in organization and planning skills. Here's an obituary that I thought you might enjoy. The lady wrestler who relished playing the heel. Mae Young, 1923 to 2014. Mae Young was 77 years old and had been a professional wrestler for more than 60 years when she agreed to grapple with a young male wrestler, Bubba Ray Dudley. Noticing his concern, Young took him aside before the match. "Hey, hotshot," she said. "If you're going to slam me, you slam me like one of the boys." Dudley politely agreed, and once in the ring, he lifted her overhead and slammed her down back first in a power bomb that broke a table. Young was unfazed. By far, that was the toughest person, pound for pound, that we've ever been in the ring with, Dudley later said. Many others, men and women alike, had said the same. Young was born the youngest of eight children in Hardscrabble, Sand Springs, Oklahoma, said the Charleston, South Carolina Post and Courier, and her father left the family before she was born and never returned. She quickly emerged as an exceptional athlete, beating boys at wrestling, playing softball, and kicking field goals for the football team. She was still a teenager when she joined the pro wrestling circuit. Lady wrestling, as the discipline was then known, took off during World War II, said the New York Times, and Mae Young quickly became one of the stars that crowds loved to hate, a frequent target of rotten eggs tossed by rowdy fans. "Anybody can be a babyface, what we call a clean wrestler," she later said. "It's the heel that carries the whole show. I've always been a heel, and I wouldn't be anything else but." Back then, Young was a lissome blonde with a movie star smile, said the Washington Post, along with the strength of a stevedore. She was arrested in 1949 in Reno, Nevada, after a man named Nelson claimed she'd beaten him up. "Maybe I did work Mr. Nelson over a little," she said at the time. "He made advances to me, improper advances." In her later years, Young lived with her friend and fellow wrestler Lillian Ellison, a.k.a. the Fabulous Moolah, in a wrestling compound outside Columbia, South Carolina, and continued to wrestle into her 80s. "She just was a rough, tough broad," one of her opponents said. Quite a character. And an equally interesting gentleman, the Japanese soldier who refused to surrender. Hiro Onoda, 1922 to 2014. When Japan formally surrendered to the Allied powers on September 2, 1945, World War II was over. But not for Hiro Onoda. The Japanese army lieutenant stationed on the Philippine island of Lubang had been given clear orders a few months earlier. Stay and fight. He did just that for another 29 years. Hiding out in the jungle, he raided villages for rice and meat, sometimes killing locals he assumed were enemy combatants. In 1974, he was finally persuaded to give up his guerrilla campaign, becoming the last World War II combatant to surrender to Allied forces. When Onoda returned to Japan, reporters asked him what he'd been thinking about for the past 30 years. "Carrying out my orders," he replied. Onoda joined the Army in 1942 and was singled out for special training in guerrilla warfare. Before he left home, he persuaded his mother to give him the family's harikari dagger, promising to disembowel himself if captured, said the Times. U.S. forces quickly captured Lubang in 1945, killing or capturing most of his comrades. The young lieutenant was among a tiny group that hid in the jungle and vowed to keep fighting. When the last of his comrades died in a gun battle with the Philippine police in 1972, Onoda's belief was reinforced that the war was still on, said the Washington Post. The Japanese government dropped leaflets to persuade Onoda to come out of hiding, but he dismissed them as Allied propaganda. Then in 1974, he encountered Japanese student Norio Suzuki, who had gone in search of Onoda. The lieutenant rejected Suzuki's pleas to go home, insisting he was still awaiting orders, said the New York Times. He yielded only after Suzuki returned with his former commander, who formally relieved the emaciated soldier of duty. Onoda was greeted as hero back in Japan, but was shocked at the changes to his land of paper and wood. Craving isolation, he became a rancher in Brazil. In 1984, he returned to Japan to set up a wilderness survival training camp for young urbanites. Too much concrete and cleanliness, he said, makes for weak children. And a couple of short notes as we wind down. America's senior citizens are indulging in a lot of unsafe sex in retirement communities and assisted living facilities. Over the past 2 years, some 2.2 million Medicare recipients received free tests for sexually transmitted diseases, about the same as the number who received free colonoscopies to screen for colon cancer. American adults consumed an average of 118 fewer calories a day in 2009-2010 than 4 years earlier. Health experts theorize that the slight decline reflects public education about diet, pressure on fast food makers to offer healthier alternatives, and a decline in dining out due to financial struggles. The combined wealth of the world's 85 richest people, $1.7 trillion, is now equivalent to that held by the poorest half of the planet's population, some 3.5 billion people, according to the study by Oxfam. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.